From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
At a time of unprecedented consensus approaching unanimity among the media, present and former senior officials of U.S. intelligence agencies, Democratic Party politicians and operatives, and establishment Republican politicians and operatives, particularly on the question of the Trump administration's foreign policy, we discuss the possible motive driving all of this with Professor Tony Montero. We spoke with him via Skype from Philadelphia on Thursday.
I think that we have been discussing possible motives for this for at least 2 years now, because if you remember, the call for impeachment began right after the election of 2016.
Right.
And the ongoing process of criminalizing him and his presidency has been going on since he was elected. And this is even before there was any Mueller investigation.
Right.
Mueller is merely the institutional expression of the political objectives of the forces who lost the election, and larger than that, the forces who are politically and financially and in other ways connected to the maintenance of this huge American empire and the military bases connected to it, almost 1,000 all around the world. And so Trump is, in fact, a subversive presidency to the interest of the order, both financial, economic, and military, that supports American hegemony. He represents, as we have said, and I don't think there's any question about it, imperial pullback.
Yep.
And certainly from the use of the military as the instrument to force nations to accept America's diktats. So I think that's what we're looking at. I don't think there's much of a question about it. Those who don't see this don't want to see it, but it is clear what this is about.
Yeah, I mean, you've characterized it for a couple of years now as imperial retreat. And, you know, when you hear a president or a national political figure recommend, who ends up becoming president for what it's worth, recommending that or demanding that, for example, the NATO countries start ponying up their share of NATO's budget, that the same thing happened with Japan and South Korea, that the military relationships, say, as described, maybe not as characterized with the terminology, but as described, go from one of occupation, say, in Japan or South Korea, to one of military alliance with their national militaries, which are to be funded and, you know, grown to the task. You're talking about imperial retreat. You're talking about a multipolar construct instead of an imperial construct centered in Washington. And you've been saying that for 2 years. Now, this article that you pointed me to yesterday, the day before yesterday in the Washington Times, this is a direct quote. President Trump says he wants to bring U.S. troops home from Syria, the Korean Peninsula, Europe, and elsewhere, and unload part of America's military burden onto other nations, defense insiders and experts say.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's it. I think that explains much of what is going on. And of course, you know, his almost immediately after he is sworn in 2017, he withdraws from the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Right, that's right.
And
That's right.
immediately, not long after that, I should say, he re-engages, in particular, Mexico, to renegotiate
NAFTA.
The
yep.
NAFTA agreement. And,
yep.
of course, this week, I think it was on Tuesday, the leaders of the AFL-CIO, the United Steelworkers, the Teamsters, the United Automobile Workers, the International Association of Machinists, and probably other unions representing the industrial unions of the nation, met with Trump at the White House concerning the renegotiation of the NAFTA agreement. Now, for almost going on close to 30 years, the labor movement has opposed NAFTA and have gotten nowhere with Republican or Democratic administrations in a renegotiation to protect the industrial workforce of the United States against this flight of capital to Mexico and other places.
Right.
But now, with Trump, there is movement on this that favors the labor movement. And then you add to this the negotiations now going on between China and the United States in Washington over resetting the trade relationships between the two nations. And from everything that I am hearing, these are quite positive and productive relationships. Then you add to that the meeting between Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump in Singapore. One of the effects or outcomes of that has been the movement towards economic integration between North and South Korea, as well as the demilitarization of the two nations, which is very, very positive. And then you add to that Trump's position in allowing Europe and the EU to determine its own relationships with Russia, separate from the big stick of NATO and the American military forces in Europe, has led to this important meeting between Angela Merkel and Vladimir Putin last week. And the meeting discussed everything from Syria, and on Syria, the repatriation of Syrian immigrants in Germany, and I would imagine other parts of Europe, back to Syria, and economic aid to help Syria rebuild from the war that was that went on there. And then you add to that the discussions in Europe about Europe taking on responsibility for its own defense, which means that without the United States in Europe, Europe will move towards détente with Russia. And there will be, I think, a demilitarization and hopefully a denuclearization of the Eurasian sphere. I am of the opinion, Don, that it might not appear in the language and the way it would make us feel comfortable. But what we see objectively occurring in the Trump administration is, as you initially put it, the acceptance of a bipolar world, the movement away, and this is not, you know, just a pretty process, because you're dealing with the institutional power of the Pentagon and the military and its supporters, who are the majority of both the Senate and House.
Right.
It's not a pretty process, but what we see is Trump's position that the world will be a place not of military confrontation, but of economic competition, which means detente with Russia, detente on the Korean Peninsula, detente with China. This is very, very important. And I think if there is a slow-moving coup d'etat, and I think there is, I think the cause of it, the reason for it, is Trump's moving back from the old military policy of the American empire.
Yeah, we've got two particular areas that we see this, that have been, you know, for the last six presidents, I'd say at least since Carter hired Brzezinski, we've had, you know, pursuing a turnaround on detente, and that's what happened when they started with, you know, Jackson, you know, all of the things that started coming into real form, the solidarity movement, quote unquote, in Poland, and that the manipulation of the loans that had been made through the IMF and others to try to take down the Polish government, you know, these different things began with Brzezinski, and they've been policy. So, in other words, turning around the policy of detente was one thing that's been happening since Carter, and then turning back on what was called the Vietnam syndrome, which was basically, after Vietnam, a rejection of U.S. interference, overt military interference in the internal affairs of other countries, that, based in the reality that had just been driven home, that there were limits to what the U.S. could impose militarily on other nations. But that lasted, like, perhaps most of Gerald Ford's presidency and about 2 weeks into Carter's, and then when he brought Brzezinski in, that became the turnaround point. This is the first time anyone's repudiated that. And, you know, not for nothing, the intervening period included the collapse of the Soviet Union. And yet this policy continued to be pursued. So now here's the thing. We're looking at a slow-moving coup. The rest of the world knows exactly what this stuff is about, particularly Russia and China. And what we have to do is ask ourselves, what are these other nations, Russia and China in particular, going to see in terms of their own security needs if they find themselves in a world where the U.S. military is under control of a government installed through a coup?
Oh, boy. Yeah. Yeah, that, and if that's a nightmare scenario, and if that is what all of this eventuates in, not only does it create a more dangerous situation for the world, but the overturning of the 2016 election by a coup d'etat, in effect, might be the beginning of the end of bourgeois democracy in the United States. And it is not Trump, and this is the irony of it all.
I know.
It is not Trump that is the threat to democracy. It is his opponents who are the threat to democracy.
Right.
I don't know how to say it more clearly, but I think we have to say it over and over and over again. Like Trump or not, agree or disagree with policies, especially in the domestic field or his rhetoric, that is not the issue. The issue is that the threat to democracy is from the opponents of Trump and not from Trump. And that threat to democracy most immediately expresses itself as an all-out effort to reverse the 2016 election. This is not to be taken lightly, and it is Orwellian, because everything is the opposite of what the dominant forces in the ruling class are saying. It is the opposite. What they accuse Trump of, it is they who are guilty of it.
Yeah. You know, I mean, one of the things that befuddles people is the I would say, inadequacy, perhaps, of the terminology. Certainly the, you know, contradictions that are nested within the use of this political terminology, starting with the word, the D word, democracy. You know, we wouldn't be facing this particular assault on the office of the presidency were it not Trump or someone challenging these particular, you know, holy of holies, NATO, et cetera, that Trump has been doing. If Hillary Clinton were elected, there'd be no crisis, there'd be no questioning the legality of the election and whether or not it was a democratic expression. In our system, we have voter caging, voter suppression, negation, racism, the stupid anti-democratic electoral college, machines that cheat, all these different things. In other words, the idea that there has been a democracy, and you can go back to 1790 or 1789 even to test it, is laughable. But what they term and what political scientists call bourgeois democracy, with the United States as one of the leading models of it, comes with all of those warts. And with all of those warts, Trump won. Whether he bribed some hooker to keep her mouth shut illegally, this, that, or the other thing, he won. And the effort to remove him is a rejection of the whole of the previous constitutional order, no matter how it's presented. And that means to people in Russia and China that are military planners that these guys that have been aiming their weapons at us since World War II and that have been wargaming us in earnest since 2014 have now abandoned their own political traditions because something is coming up imminently that's so big that they don't even want to waste a moment on that stuff. And so how are they going to read it?
No, in fact, in spite of the trade war, and I put quotes around that, between China and the United States, and really the Trump administration's attempt to renegotiate the trade and economic relations between China and the United States, and the Chinese are not necessarily hostile towards it, and all of these gestures
it's
of tariffs and so on. It's a dance. The fact of the matter is that that China is prepared to be treated by the United States not as an emerging market, but as a major economic power in the world. So we have this resetting of the geo-economic situation. And I don't think Mexico is against it in the renegotiating of NAFTA. And China is not against renegotiating its economic relationships with the United States, recognizing that Trump's policy, whether his way of doing it will be successful, is the reindustrialization of the United States and the getting of the American working class out of this 50-year decline in the standard of living. And that's what he's doing. And everybody recognizes that. They understand that this is the exercise of sovereignty, but they also realize that from the U.S. standpoint, this president is saying that the terms of the WTO and the global financial system that serves Wall Street and the big banks in the United States and Europe is coming to an end. That is what Trump is trying to do. But, you know, I'd like to take a step back. Since there are those who argue about how much they miss Barack Obama because they don't like Trump's style. Well, let's look at things. And we're, of course, this is hypothetical, but I think there's some logic to it. Take the invasion of Libya and the murder of Muammar Gaddafi. That was under Obama. Do you think Trump, based upon what we know now, that Trump would have done that? I don't think so.
No.
Take the overthrow, the coup d'etat in the Ukraine. and the installation of what is a far right, if not fascist, regime. Do you think Trump would have been involved in that? I don't think so.
Right.
Take Syria. Would he have been involved in that? I don't think so. Let's go back to the Bush administration, the invasion of Iraq.
Right.
I don't think Trump would have pursued that policy. Right. Now, maybe you say that was 2003, that was 15 years ago. Yeah. I'm saying knowing perhaps what he knows now and the conclusions that he drew from that, I think, one, he would be very critical of it. He would not have supported the invasion of Afghanistan.
Right.
I think, and I'll say it again, that Trump is the most peace, pro-peace president that we've had since John F. Kennedy.
Right. Now, I mean, this is what befuddles people, too. I've seen some of the responses that have been posted in various social media to that assertion by you and by myself and others that, you know, that have presented it. And, you know, and it comes packaged with ridicule from people who, you know, think that the Obama presidency was a time of peace, that, you know, and point to his Nobel Peace Prize as part of the evidence. But, you know, the problem, the kernel of the truth of the statement is you're comparing him, of course, to the other American presidents. We've got Johnson and Nixon and Ford and Carter and Reagan and Bush and Clinton and Bush and Obama. Compared to them, that which is the statement you're making, that's exactly true. These people, you know, Johnson started the Vietnam War, took millions of lives. Nixon prosecuted the Vietnam War, probably took another million lives while he was doing it. And also that coup in Chile is on his hands, and a whole lot of stuff between the two of them happened in Africa with a lot of lives, I would say again, in the millions lost over that. Gerald Ford wasn't president long enough to really make a lot of trouble and inherited detente from Nixon, which is something that was achieved by in Nixon's time. Then Carter comes along with Brzezinski, who ultimately ends up taking down through the next two administrations the Warsaw Pact, but starts a war in Afghanistan that's still being fought today. So, you know, saying, guess what? We didn't learn the lesson of Vietnam. You think it was bad that that war went from 74 to from 54 to 74? We're going to start one now in 79 that's going to run till at least 2018. Okay, it's already like another 10 years longer than the Vietnam War. So he repudiates that. Reagan comes in with his boys. They're ready to start World War III. Bush starts the war in Iraq that continues until today.
Clinton and Afghanistan.
And continues that again. I'm talking Bush 1.
He
starts the war in Iraq in 1991. Then Clinton starts the first war in Europe since 1945. Destroys Yugoslavia, by the way, blows up Somalia, a few other places, starves half a million kids to death and brags about it in Iraq, et cetera, et cetera. Bush starts Iraq too and Afghanistan too. And so compared to those guys, what has Trump done that puts him in that class? Nothing.
That's true. And you know, the other thing is, I think we have to divide this period that you've outlined between the period of the Cold War when the Soviet Union and the socialist bloc exist, which was always kind of a stopper, a challenge to the global hegemonic ambitions or desires of American imperialism.
Right.
But the most dangerous period since the end of World War II begins with the collapse of the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
And this is when the idea of a unipolar world is put forward by the U.S. military and the politicians associated with it, where they openly say that this is a time of a single superpower. This becomes the most dangerous moment in world history since World War II. This has been close to a 30-year period. Now, Trump comes in, and by opposing the unipolar world and thus objectively supporting an imperialist pullback and saying, in effect, economic competition and military detente, if not military pullback, is the sine qua non of his global policies. This makes him certainly the most pro-peace candidate since the collapse of the Soviet Union. But I think for the reasons that you have given since John F. Kennedy. Now, for those who think that is a joke, that is something to be ridiculed, I want them to put forward the alternative logic and evidence to it, especially in light of the article on Monday in the Washington Times, which I think is reliable. I think it is a valid expression of what is going on, especially given what we know. Even if you take Iran with all of the bluster and the gestures towards belligerency that Trump has made towards Iran, let us not forget that he said, and I am prepared to meet with them anytime and anywhere. Have we seen that scenario before? Yes, with North Korea. I mean, look, I don't know how you can make a counter argument to it. Now, I know there are people who claim to be radical thinkers and revolutionaries and Marxists and all this, that, and the other, who will say, but this is a fight within the ruling class, and Trump is attempting to take down the CIA and the national security state in order to impose a total fascist regime in the United States.
Right.
My question to them is, what makes you think that we did not have a, quote, total fascist regime in place already,
right,
organized by the NSA, the CIA, and all of these 17 or how many intelligence agencies? It did not take a presidential election to do that. I think most people, but I think there's a shift going on. Most people that look at these things from whatever angle, from the angle of the deep state or the angle of the left, who look at these things seriously, recognize that what we are seeing is a profound movement away from this single superpower war, military hegemony policy, to multipolar world, military detente, military pullback, and economic competition.
You know, I can only reply and close with what Fukuyama said when he was asserting at the end of the Cold War, essentially that history had ended because mankind had reached the fulfillment of its ideological evolution. And that was the universalization of Western liberal democracy. In other words,
right.
We win. And a mere 28 years later, we're seeing its collapse. Tony, thank you very much.
That's all the news we have
for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.